Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in Animal Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. My name is Yakir, your host today. And today we will speak about the book Beast Without Purpose. The book Beast Without Purpose emerges from the idea of an end to human sovereignty over non-human animals. From this ahumanistic approach, the author conceptualized several ideas for rethinking the crisis of non-humans and for rethinking non-human animals themselves. The non-human, be it a domesticated animal, a beast, or a monster, is being reconsidered through the concept of radical grace, an act of human grace in its favor, or through a geographical concept of true animal liberation and human restraint. Beast Without Purpose is a beast that does not sit in wait for humanistic judgment, but rather heads out to a new soil free from human domination. The author, our guest today, Oren Ben Yosef, is a writer and animal rights activist and an art teacher from Israel. He has talked and written extensively on human-animal relations and has published 3 books on this subject.
Oren, thank you so much for joining us to the New Books Network.
Thank you, Akil. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. I would like to start with, you open your book by saying that the definition of post-colonialism is that the person, that the white person who come to Africa, and you bring a beautiful quote from the Book of Young, think that he brought Africa into his story, or what we will call history. But actually, what the white colonial person did is that they deleted the whole life and culture of the people in Africa in that case. And we try to bring them and their narrative into the white narrative, the white European or white American narrative. And you say exactly the same is happening with animals. Actually, nature, or which include humans, but really not only, the animals have a narrative. Narrative with different maybe perception, different understanding, but they have a narrative, and actually humans, we try to slave them into our narrative. So I love your opening because it's totally changed everything how we think about our relationship with nature. I would love if you can share with us more about that.
Thank you. Yes, I remember watching some video, I think it was on YouTube, probably about 15 years ago, maybe even more, where an African shaman was talking about how the youth of his, where he lived, I don't remember where exactly in Africa, I'm sorry, they don't know they have a history. To them, history begins with exactly with the white man who came to Africa. This is when history began for them. And among other things, it is the work of this shaman to correct them and tell them about the true history. And going back to animals, because while I'm talking about a lot of parallels between humans and animals, I focus in my books on animals and on how we treat them and how we perceive them. Exactly the same happens with them. In a lot of you can think about dogs and about all other domesticated animals. From like one end of the spectrum is the animals we call pets, and the other end of the spectrum is the animals we call farm animals, lab animals, and animals we exploit more violently than we do with pets. And we do exploit pets. We breed them in horrific ways to create new breeds and quote unquote perfect the breeds into things you cannot even compare anymore to wolves and to the ancestors of dogs. And to us, this is the new life. And it begins, you mentioned the word nature. I think it begins right there, you know, when a small child in the kindergarten draw a picture of a man or human, I don't know, girl, boy, doesn't matter, and the background. Like nature, the grass, the sky, the sun, it's the background of the image. We learn from like very young age to separate the foreground from the background, the foreground being us. And we, like in some alleged and self-proclaimed Promethean way, we bring a new purpose, a new meaning to the lives of animals. The cow won't be just a wild cow somewhere in the wild grass is somewhere far away from humans. The cow will have her place in human society. This is her place now. And more often than not, it's for our benefit, of course, and not for them. So when I'm being an activist for the sake of animals, animal liberation and animal rights for the last, I think, 10 years, perhaps more, and you talk to a lot of people and you keep hearing these claims that this is what there are for. The cow is there for specific purposes. This is her purpose in life. This is her purpose on this world. Without the, if we're talking about cows, without the milk industry and the meat industry, there wouldn't be any cows or that many cows that there are now. So we use these claims which that evolve into excuses. We use these in order to maintain a certain order of things of how the world should be managed and how it is managed. Like we don't, and we, you know, we like to talk about nature and always. I'm sorry. We like to talk about nature in order to defend some the way we harm others. Like it's human nature to do that. We're supposed to eat meat. But when we talk about nature, we don't consider it really to be the wild nature that is oblivious to human needs and human wants. We want to tame nature as well. Even when we talk about the wild nature, it's supposed to be the nature that is in our control. And this is what humans have been trying to do ever since the first human, but more successfully in the agricultural revolution and later in the industrial revolution. So this is where we are now.
Yeah, I love it, Oren. I think that there are maybe three kind of categories. One is how we really behave with animals that are not pets. The second is the picture, the image that we try to give humans in order that we can continue with the industry of animals, which is a picture, you know, of the, you go to walk in nature in Switzerland and you see a few cows and they look super chill. This is the cows that we see normally. It's not the cows in, right? In the way how in the Auschwitz, I'm sorry to go there, but the way how we, how some of my friends, they call it, right? And then we have the nature that we almost never go to visit, or if we go, we call it like the danger, like the jungle, where we know that we do not control and we super afraid from that.
Exactly. And ever since, especially ever since the Enlightenment, our mission is, it became to control this nature and to make this what I call monstrous, this monstrous side of nature, the one that not only we don't control, but also threatens to control us. We try to make it as small and as insignificant as possible. Of course, we can't do that really. And Michel Foucault writes about human cemeteries and about slaughterhouses that used to be in the center of the village or the town in the past and slowly moved away to the side of away from our eyes, like from our daily lives, because it's not, we don't really want to see that. And this is exactly what happened. And all again, I go back to young children at kindergarten. But all every time we talk about cows, we talk about chickens, we imagine this happy pastoral environment in which they live and graciously give us their products with love. Until you go there and you see how it really looks like.
Right. And before we'll go there, I want to stay a little bit more with the narrative we're creating. And some things that you tell us in your book to look at is about the difference between the wording. So we have the word humanistic, which is the ultimate way how human beings should behave. And we think that this is the ultimate way how to behave in the world, to be humanistic. But actually, it includes only humans. And we cut out all the animals. And then on the other side, we have the beast, the animal, that we need to be worried from. It's like, this is our enemy that we need to deal with.
Yes, exactly. I'm an art teacher, and I teach a lot about the Renaissance. I talk with my pupils about the moment when, to a certain degree, you know, in Italy, people became more secular, and humanism, and talked about humanism, about putting humans in the center instead of the church, instead of the state, and what a huge and positive step it is. However, and exactly when you look at the broadest picture, this is still very problematic on a planetary point of view. Like you have a lot of other beings who vanish from our recognition or from our consideration, because we think about the humans and their place in the world and how the world should help humans to their ends. And so we end up with really, on the first glance, I think the strange terms like a humane slaughter, which is that the act of killing someone even with no provocation. However, ultimately, I think this is regardless of if it's if this sort of humane slaughter has its I hate to say positive sides, but a little more comforting methods of killing, it's still humane and humanistic because it doesn't really see the animal. Humane slaughter is the act of slaughtering, of killing an animal for the sake of humans. And so linguistically we can say, yes, every slaughter is humane slaughter because it's for the human. And furthermore, we treat animals better in humane slaughter, not for their sake. It's ultimately for the consumer's sake. Because maybe we want to eat these animals, but something is still bothering us about their well-being. So a humane way to kill them will make us consumers more calm and satisfied with how things work in the world, you know. And ultimately, this is an act for humans, not for the animals. The animals, if I'll be allowed to talk in their name, know exactly what they would have wanted, and this doesn't have anything to do with either humane slaughter or inhumane slaughter. They want to be left alone, live their lives, and if possible, be happy, like us, exactly like us.
Which is fascinating. You know, I'm thinking about our Jewish tradition. And you, many times in your book, you go to the, you bring quotes from, you know, from the Bible, and you think about them. And I think about two narratives. One is, I grew up in a Hasidic community, and one of the narratives is that animals desire to be eaten by us because we will bless, we will say the blessing, and this is what will, in a mystical way, will make them to be a full animals, like to the main thing, because we will bless on the food. This is one way. But then we have a different narrative, beautiful story in the Jewish old texts, the Talmud, the Gemara, where we have Rabbi Yehuda, the president, who saw once a cow, which is taken to be slaughtered. And the cow was crying. And she said in the story, she said to Rabbi Yehuda, the president, please tell them not to kill me. And he said, this is what you were created to. And Rabbi Yehuda Nasi didn't do anything, and he was punished for that for 13 years of suffering that ended when he took care or on some little rats or mouses. And I'm thinking about these two narratives. It's two seriously different contradict narratives, but both serve us. And then you bring, and I want just to mention that and to hear you about the place of our Jewish tradition or any narrative, you mentioned Hevel in Hebrew, that in a way he was the good brother between him and Cain. And Cain, we think about him as the first murderer, right, who killed Hevel. But you say, no, Hevel is the first killer because he brought sacrifice to God from animals, where Cain actually brought smells or, right? And then we have the snake in the story of Adam and Eve, who is a bad guy, who is a bad animal, not guy, but animal. So I wonder about the place of narrative that the Jewish tradition or any other tradition bring us into.
Thank you. Yes, this is like under the circumstances, of course, but this is like a very interesting point to discuss and to examine, because on my second book, Beast Without Purpose in English, I talk about like the spectrum of animals between like the domesticated one and to the beast, which is the undomesticated animal, and furthermore to the monster that scares us much more than the beast. But the beast also is an unwanted condition in nature in the human point of view. And both of the stories you told now, one I knew, the other I didn't, they put the cow in the same place, not of a beast, but of an animal, a domesticated animals that is here for a purpose which is in the end humanistic. It doesn't matter if it was put here to merely to die for whatever sacraments or rituals humans do, or maybe the cow really wants to help us transcend our material life, maybe. And either way, it doesn't matter, because the bottom line is the cow is there for us. Like the end of the spectrum is being cut away. The cow is no beast. There are no beasts. I think if we talk about the Bible, then maybe the story of Noah is the is the end of all possibility of peace in the world. I'm thinking about it right now, but perhaps this is the point, because now it is a human who takes all animals for the world of the future. As to Cain and Abel, yes, exactly. This is another, again, the same thing. Like, there is a story, like the sacrifice of Isaac is the same thing, even though it happens later on. But there is a story that has a meaning for us, and it is a story for us. And the protagonists of the story and the antagonists are humans, and yes, there is an animal there, but it's merely a prop or a way for us to either do what we do or think what we think. Like, it doesn't matter that Abel killed living beings. What matters in the story is that Abel's sacrifice was accepted and Cain was not. So the life of the of these animals, of these beasts, is negligent in the story. They're merely part of the story, as well in the sacrifice of Isaac. Like the ram that they find at the end of the story is like a Deus ex machina for a sacrifice for God. There was a test, and there are beautiful criticism and the discussions about this story, even in more secular philosophy books in Israel. Dr. Yitzhak Binyamini from Wrestling talks about this story a lot. And but at the end, like, there is the test, let's call it the test, for Abraham, but no, like, in the end of the story, there is a killing. The story ends with the killing. The story ends with someone, and the ram is someone who is being killed. And this is, so the story is not a sacrifice, and it should not be called the sacrifice of Isaac, which is another way to diminish the animal. It's a sacrifice of the ram. The ram was sacrificed. So we can see how non-humans become extinct, even in the way we talk about them, and in the way we talk about their own killings. So I think, like, these are very important points in the Bible, and I don't write a lot about the Bible, but I'm really secular, but I do attach some stories to explain further points in my books, but these are ways that we have placed the position of the animal in our mind, even from early eras of the Bible.
Right. And Owen, you speak a lot in your book about movies that, yes, can maybe help us to understand what we are doing. And one of them is about the question of signs, because in a way, a lot of the cruelty is happening under the name of science. And I think if we can think about that together with Michel Foucault and the place of science in history from the Enlightenment is fascinating. And you take, like, movies like The 12 Monkeys, if I remember well, yes, and you show us that there is something that we cannot close our eyes to what we do to animals in the name of science. But officially, we do it in order to save humans. And sometimes we do it in order to make the genetic of animals, but actually it's also for us, because we want to have the animals we want to have. So I wonder if you can lead us to these fascinating chapters where you speak about the place of science and the industry of science into the life of animals?
Yes, this is a very important aspect as well. And speaking about 12 Monkeys, which is a movie I really love, 12 Monkeys begin with like a very peculiar point in which the world exists. In the story, the humans live underground, and the hero is chosen to go to the dangerous surface to pick some specimens for the world below. And what we see out there, like a frozen city that is being ruled by beasts, truly beasts now, as no human is in control of the place. You see, I think what Boris Groys talked about it, of course, regardless of the movie and the others, as anti-utopia. I mean, we talk a lot about utopia and dystopia, which are very, very too close to each other. In both ways, it's the complete human rule of the world, for better or for worse. And we can talk about the criticism about utopian thinking for ages. But there is also the anti-utopia, which is really the opposite of utopia, not dystopia. In anti-utopia, humans lose control of the world. And the world is given in this movie back to nature, quote unquote. So this is a really interesting beginning for the movie. We can see it in other movies. I think about I think it was called Waterworld with Kevin Costner, and like even on an older movie. But and anyway, in this movie, we meet this group of radical animal rights liberation, animal rights activists who work directly against a scientist who perform animal experiments. And to a point, these activists are being blamed for the end of the world, for why the world has come to become an anti-utopian, and how most of the mankind has been extinct. And we can see the same thing in a zombie apocalypse movie 20 days later, 28 days later, sorry. The movie begins with the breaking and entering of a group of animal liberation activists into a lab. They all are very violent and very angry. The scientist we see them is a poor person wearing a white robe, helpless against the violent activists, and he tries to warn them not to release the monkeys because the monkeys have a very dangerous virus in them. But of course, they don't listen to him, and so they are responsible for the end of the world. So we can see in these two examples how those who oppose science we're talking about science, the self-proclaimed objective examiner, but ultimately the destroyer of lives, of non-human lives. So those who oppose this kind of science are responsible to the end of the world, which is quite a serious accusation, which can tell us, viewers, about the place of this kind of science in the world. Like, you don't want to be on the other side of this equation because look what happens. And I think that if we talk about, I worked as a manager for the Israeli Society for the Abolition of Vivisection for a few years. And even until today, I deal with scientists and vivisectioners in debates, and they talk to people against all kinds of animal experiments, no matter what their purposes are. And usually, like, there is this, first of all, an impenetrable aura around this field. Like we can talk about eating animals, yes or no, and ultimately, and frankly, there is nothing to say in favor of eating animals. I'm sorry to say, except people like the taste. There is nothing to defend. But the discussion becomes much more serious and energetic and emotional when we talk about science, because there is this equation about of human lives against animal lives, and when presented with this equation, what you're supposed to do is prefer the human life. But of course, this equation is artificial, because these animals have nothing to do with the problems we usually cause to ourselves. And you can see the case of the COVID plague as a perfect example for that. And it's only because we chose to perform these violent experiments on animals that we do that. It's nothing, nothing else. And so this point of scientific approach to the insignificance of animal life sometimes is the umbrella for all considerations of non-humans. And this is like a very, very, big problem. I talk a lot with every year I meet with researchers and students who either are performing experiments or are about to perform experiments on animals. And I say that first of all, you know, you should, according to what you do, it's not like that the humans are the first place and animals are the second place, and then what we have nothing to do, we have to look after the beings in the first place. Animals are the zero place. They have nothing, they have no value. And you can see it in the way researchers, some researchers, maybe I should say, manipulate their methods of experiments and research in order to do what they want against the very, very soft regulations they have in the place where they work. And again, we can talk about these scientists and say, were you all vegan people who fight for the sake of animals? But when you go to the lab, you say, okay, right now there is no other choice. I have to harm these animals. The discussion would be very different. Of course, I would be still against it, but the discussion would be different. But it doesn't, because you don't. Because animals have no place in the world of humans. And I use a lot of movies, like you said, especially in my last book. My last book is called Animal Eaters, World Eaters, I'm sorry. And it talks about science fiction and the way we think about alien beings in science fiction, and even today, as compared to the way we treat non-human earthing beings here. I don't discuss the actual question if there are lives on other worlds. I don't know. I assume there are, but it's not the subject of my book, but how we think about them. And I use a lot of movies and television shows which happen in the future where we meet these beings. And I ask also, I show examples of how we can go back to Jung and talk about human imperialism, how it happens across the galaxy, not only on planet Earth. And we can see, we can think, like we can imagine now, like do a thought practice about a new world that human will discover one day, which is populated with what I called, like as a joke, by space cows and space dogs and space birds. I mean, like counterparts of what we know here on Earth. And we can imagine what the future is going to be once a human foot is going to step on this world. It's the end of it's their apocalypse. Their apocalypse begins when we step on the new world. which is exactly what happened in the Americas and other places on Earth.
Which is fascinating, and it brings me to another question, which is, Oren, I mean, killing is happening in nature, yeah. Right? I mean, I love hiking and camping, so many times I stay nights in the middle of forests or mountains. And when you listen to the voices and when you know about predators who are coming, I mean, it's not easy to be an animal in the forest. So killing is happening. And I wonder, maybe killing is part of nature, since animals also kill animals to eat. And I wonder if there are ways that you can imagine, or maybe there are some traditions, I think maybe about some traditions in non-Western societies, where you go to kill an animal in order to eat it with your tribe, but you behave with the animal that, you know, in a, you pray and you only kill in order to eat. I just wonder about, is it like or nothing or everything? Or maybe there are ways that we can behave more like actually not human, but more actually like nature.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. I have several books that deal with the problem of animal pain in a from a Christian perspective. And one of them, I think, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name right now, Osborne. I'm sorry, Mr. Osborne, if you listen to this podcast, but I can't remember the first name. He begins the book with a trip he had somewhere in the jungle, and how we see like swollen bodies of cadavers of animals and alligators eating so much that they cannot move. And he describes like a very, very brutal nature. And nature is brutal, of course. This is, again, one of the humanistic problems, that nature is usually green grass and carefully planted trees. No, nature is not nice. And a lot of not nice things happens in nature. And I think that ultimately, for better or worse, we are not, you can say that everything that happens is part of nature, of course, but to a certain extent, we're not there. We control our evolution, and we do things that weren't supposed is a big world, that wouldn't happen should the humans gain their technological advancements that they did. And we can do without it. This is the bottom line. Let's talk first of all about the Western world and then go to other places. So I think that first of all, in the Western world, there's no question, like you mustn't harm animals. Like it's harming other beings. Where you go to different cultures and societies, these are not the first places that I would go to stop animal abuse. But in the end, this is violence toward other beings. From my point of view, this is the end of the story. Like we don't human violence is part of our history as well, but we try to stop it, at least allegedly, to stop the commonality of it, at least. We don't say, okay, like there wasn't any time in history that humans didn't kill humans, so let's have at it. We don't do that. So I think I'm not really like utopian about it. I don't think there's going to be a point in the future, in a future that we can predict, like not regarding AI and immersive consciousness and things like that, but a future we can predict that there will be an end to animal abuse, because I can't perceive a future in which there will be an end to human abuse. And if right. we can't predict the end of human violence, how can we think about the, right. the end of animal violence? But we need to strive to end it, nevertheless, the way we do with human violence. So like a similar question can be asked about people who raise the chickens in their yard or in their farm, and they lead the really good lives, and from time to time they take their eggs. I mean, like, technically this doesn't bother me much as long as you don't harm the animals, but ultimately I don't think this is how we should live, on the expense of others, on the one-sided, let's call it in as a bitter joke, a one-sided symbiosis of human and non-human. So my vision or what I want in the world is the end of violence, which is, I say it right now, it's like it's non-realistic wish, unfortunately, but I think that we should strive towards it, at least in the same way we strive toward the end of human violence.
So interesting.
And,
it's so interesting what you say, because you actually give us different, what is interesting about humanity, that we can choose where we want to put ourselves, right? So
yeah.
As I look at that now, and maybe we can go back to the question, to the story of Noah, because in the Jewish tradition, before Noah and the story of the Ark, we were not allowed to eat animals. So according to the narrative, before that, we were like this kind of animal, this section of animals who are eating only vegetables or grass. And after Noah, we are allowed to eat animals. But actually, even worse than that, it's not only that we are allowed to eat animals. Noah, the first thing that he does when he leaves the ark is to take animals and to sacrifice them to the name of the divine, to God. And this is like the three layers that you speak about. It's like the cruelty that we create, we use animals to our narrative. Then there is the eating animals that make us to be like animals who are predators, who eat others. And then the animals that you strive to be, which is to be part of this group of animals that do not hurt each other. And I love it. I love it because you give us, you put the responsibility on us to choose where we want to be.
Yes, and this is like a very problematic thing to do, because usually we as a like society or culture or state, or we don't usually think too much forward. Like I love among a lot of other things, something that Slavoj Žižek says a lot, like instead of don't think, do, don't do, think. Meaning, just stop for a second and think forward, think about consequences, think about the future. Don't do without considering the consequences. And we can see that today, like on one second you hear about the planet Earth burning to ash, and the other you see how billionaires boast about leaving the atmospheres for 5 seconds in their new spaceships, and their plans of automatic cars and how they see the future, regardless of the impact it's going to have on, and I'm even not talking about the animals being used in Elon Musk's experiments on his Neuralink, but even on humans who In the United States, like so many people are working as truck drivers, and this is a job that is really in the danger, is facing extinction with the arrival of the automatic cars, autonomic cars. So this is like a simple example of how you can like run forward and change things, or how they call it in the Silicon Valley, break stuff without considering the consequences. This is what we usually do. So what I try to do is hold on. Let's think for a second. In the book Beast Without Purpose, I'm giving like theoretical tools to change the way we look at the world. And in the book World Eaters, I'm asking to look at humanity in an even broader scope and see what it does to the world. And so let's chill. let's wait for a second and not run and break stuff. I'm talking about the act of grace. And
we the radical grace.
Yes, to we can go back to some theistic point of view again. I compare it. There is a beautiful book called The Secular Grace in Hebrew by Dana Friedbach Heffetz, and I'm talking about, she talks about the act of grace between humans, and I'm talking about the act of grace between a human and a non-human, and I compare it to the act of grace between God and the human, in which in both cases, like, we don't have any way to repay God for the act of grace. And in the same way, non-humans have no way to repay us for our act of grace. And sometimes they don't even know an act of grace is being bestowed upon them. We saved about 30 turkeys from a lab. We got a call. The people from the lab said, listen, we finished this experiment. The turkeys are fine. On Sunday, we're going to kill them because we don't have anything to do with them. If you want them, come and take them. So we stopped everything and we took 28, I think, turkeys who were scared to death. They didn't know what's going on because they were in their environment, and suddenly they're in carton boxes being put in a car. They were scared to death because they didn't know that we are actually saving their lives. So this is like an example of how you can change the life of a non-human so radically, and first of all, not expect any gratitude from the animal, as you should. You're doing the right thing, that should be enough. And second of all, with no way for the other side, meaning the animal, repay you. And thirdly, even without the animal knowing what you're doing. So I'm giving this example as a way to take a different look at the beings around us, at the non-human beings around us, in a way we can not exploit them, not use them for our end, but rather the opposite, like help them, simply help them in life. We're all, to quote Heidegger, maybe like thrust into this world, into this existence, and we're all here together. In this life, against, let's call it the end of it, against death. And so let's just help each other as much as we can. I'm not utopian. I know there are limits. I know I'm responsible for some deaths myself, unfortunately, in the way I live. I try to do my best, but I know I'm not perfect. No one is. But let's make the effort to help, and or at least not to harm as many beings as we can.
It's so beautiful.
And another subject I'm talking about in this book, in Beast Without Purpose, it's about trans. I call it now. This is very utopian, unfortunately, today. But about transnational wilderness, like the theoretical zones on planet Earth that should be left without any human control over them, not being part of any state on the planet. That, like, the idea that some human states will just release and give, let's call it, give independence to places in the jungle, places in the savannas, I don't know, that in which humans will not be the rulers. And unfortunately, not a very realistic thing to do today. I think it's a very nice way of thinking about, of rethinking about the world and about our environment. Like, maybe we shouldn't control everything around us.
Fascinating. And there is another podcast that I did with two fascinating scholars, Wilderness, that speaks exactly about these questions of the wilderness and the wilderness and the place of humans inside it. Oren, first of all, thank you so much. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe I will end, we will end with another beautiful midrash, a Jewish text that says that the reason why Adam and Eve were born in the sixth day and not in the first day is to tell them, if you take responsibility on the world, we created the world also for you to be there. But if not, if you don't know how to behave in the world, so every other creature was here before you. So don't try to control. And
And
I love how you bring us not also the theoretical in your book and the narrative. You really don't try to bring the narrative of the animals, but you really show what the narratives that we choose and also practically how to do it differently. So thank you so much for joining us to the New Books Network. It was a gift.
Thank you for having me. It was really, really a pleasure, and I'm happy to talk about these subjects. Thank you.